Welcome to episode 466 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a grand conversation with writer, lawyer, professor, Michael Blumenthal. We discuss growing up in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan, being lost, having time to figure things out, justice, the human condition, Hungary, white space on the page, his relationship with David Souter, drinking with George Conrad, Carl Jung, the human psyche, the power of evil versus the power of good. Just some light subject matter. A grand conversation with Michael Blumenthal this go round. We have an EWSA titled Branches, and we share an excerpt from Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. And we have a poem called Prince. All of this, of course, will be infused, imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to be with you. Let's get to it, then. Episode 466 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. The years are numbered, and you wonder if you are ever going to get it. David Sedaris reminded me the other night during a lecture the importance of connection, hearing, listening, seeing. It's April 1st today, and being a fool is on full display. Walking around the neighborhood up in these mountains with a white, long, uneven beard, balding with a ponytail and pockets filled with plastic bags from the grocery store, as I walk Katie Girl on a long leash. The clouds are gray and white. The early morning light reflects and refracts through little raindrop spectrums, each a potential origin of rainbows hanging from early budding branches that form acute angles out of the trunk from which they grow. The road is asphalt and gravel. Curbs are torn up and broken from the plowing too aggressive of winter snow. Katie Girl and I seem to know where to go. The way this all works, the way it all lays still, yet is a part of a natural flow, amazes me throughout these days and nights. Despite how clueless and contrite actions might otherwise represent, the life I see in my small fishbowl world, the reach for understanding something so vast and to connect with it is far more easy, I suppose, than actually connecting with you. Until next time, I bid you adieu.
Waiting for the sunrise, waiting for the sunrise, waiting for the sunrise.
Michael Blumenthal. Is that you?
Yeah, that's still me.
It's so nice for you to be with us here at Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Thank you.
My pleasure to be with you.
Let me get started first by sharing a little background information for our listeners. Michael Blumenthal, formerly director of creative writing at Harvard, graduated from the Cornell Law School in 1974 and was visiting professor of law at the West Virginia University College of Law from 2009 through 2017. His first collection of short stories, The Greatest Jewish American Lover in Hungarian History, was published by Etruscan Press in 2014. And Etruscan also published his eighth book of poems, titled No Hurry, Poems from 2000 through 2012 in 2013. He is the author of the memoir All My Mothers and Fathers, HarperCollins, 2002, and his novel Wine Stock Among the Dying won Hadassah Magazine's Harold U. Riblow Prize for the Best Work of Jewish Fiction. A collection of his radio essays for NPR entitled Just 3 Minutes, Please, Thinking Out Loud on Public Radio was published in 2014. And his collaboration with the baboon conservationist Rita Miljo, Because They Needed Me, The Incredible Struggle of Rita Miljo to Save the Orphaned Baboons of South Africa, was published in May 2016. And his Don't Die, Poems from 2013 through 2021, was published by the Rabbit House Press in 2021. Troubadours and Rock on Tours is so very happy to have on our program Michael Blumenthal. Thank you, sir. What an impressive, very sort of eclectic resume or CV, I should say.
Well, eclectic is a nice word for it. I think it was also the product of a very confused bunch of years, but it looks good on paper. That's true.
And well, tell us a bit about that. Like, tell us about your background. You are. Where are you from originally? How about that? And how did you end up with being a writer, a psychotherapist, a translator, law professor, and so on?
They're all fairly brief answers. The answer to the second part is most of these things happened by accident, but by nice, positive accidents mostly. I grew up in Washington Heights in New York. My parents were refugees from the Holocaust who came over in 1938, and it was a largely German, Spanish, English-speaking neighborhood. English was, I think, third. And I went to the Bronx High School of Science, and then at the age of 16, I went off to college in Binghamton, New York. And, you asked me how these things happened. I think it's not so flattering to say this, but, you know, for many, many years, I was so lost that I just kind of stumbled from one thing to another. Part of that being because I went to college at a very, very young age, and I was not even just 20 when I graduated. And by the time I really figured out what I was interested in, I was on another track. So I was a bit like a train that had gone quite far down one track and was trying to change tracks. And so I wound up, at 20, I became a high school German teacher. The joke was that I was the only teacher whose mother had to sign his contract because I was under the... And then I wound up going to law school. After all, I got the highest score on the law boards that anybody in my undergraduate school had ever had. And my brother was a lawyer, and you know, on paper, I was economics, political science kind of major. And I was lost, so I didn't know what to do. I had just begun being interested in the things that I really was interested in, and so I went off to law school. At the age of 22.
And which law school was that, out of curiosity?
That was at Cornell.
Cornell, that's right. That was in the bio.
Right.
Did you enjoy Ithaca as a 22-year-old kid studying law?
Well, yeah, I mean, Ithaca's a beautiful town, especially if you like rain, you know. But it is a beautiful town. I didn't too much enjoy law school, you know, but I don't think at that point in my life I would have enjoyed anything, so it didn't really matter what I was doing. But I didn't quite fit as a lawyer, although I wound up as a law professor. My career sort of ended as a law professor, strangely enough. But I did clerk one summer for David Souter, who later became a Supreme Court justice. Wow. Not when he was on the Supreme Court. He was at the Attorney General's office in New Hampshire. And so, you know, I spent many years wandering around trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. And so I was lucky enough, maybe because at that period it was still a kind of advantage to be a middle-class, white, Jewish, educated boy from New York, and you could make the kind of mistakes I made or fall into the kinds of things that I fell into. I don't know if that would be possible now, but I was lucky, in a sense, to come of age at a time when you could still sort of make all kinds of mistakes and still wind up somehow with your feet on the ground.
Well, why do you think that might not be so possible today?
Well, I think, you know, it's a different world. I mean, in every possible way, it's a different world. It's a different world economically. You know, my son's generation can't afford to rent an apartment or buy a house. It's a different world socioeconomically and culturally, as it should be in some ways. But, you know, it's not a world where just because you're a white middle-class male, every door is open to you and closed to many other people. So it's a different world. It really is a radically different world. You know, I don't want to sound so old. I'm not that old. But sometimes I think back upon what the world of 1969 was and what it is now, and it's more surreal than any science fiction could render it.
The change from 69 to now?
Everything. Yes.
And
everything.
I mean,
the human condition hasn't changed, but all the little details in which it has to function have changed totally. Literary life, academic life, professional life, you name it.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned that in some ways certain changes, right, had to happen, but because there's injustice and disparity and all that, and we can't overlook it, and we shouldn't ignore it. But I guess there's also some things that maybe aren't better. Is that fair for me to have interpreted?
I think many things are not better. I think that's how history works. You know, some things get better, and some things get worse. It's not a straight line. And so some things have clearly gotten better. I don't think any person would argue with the fact that we have more just society, not a just society, but more just regarding minorities and gays and all kinds of people than we had 50 years ago. But certain things have gotten arguably worse. the fact that we elected Donald Trump as president testifies to that, I think. How much worse can it get than that?
Yes, it makes me laugh because that whole period was so absurd. And people, I don't know about where you live, but people still have, you know, Trump signs in their yards around here.
Well, I live in a state that that voted 74% for Trump. This is the second Trumpiest state in the union after Wyoming. So, yes, you could still find many of them here. He would win by more today.
Isn't that wild? I mean, it's like, you are an educated person. You have spend a lot of your time learning about how the mind works and how to do research, how to communicate, how to be a critical, independent thinker, and then to look around and see a lot of fellow citizens who don't exercise any of that, aren't interested in any of that. That must drive you nuts.
Well, you know, I have never gotten over the shock and the shame of Trump's election. It changed my view of everything, but, you know, one thing I realized, I often write, not often, but I occasionally write editorials for the newspapers, and I just wrote a piece called The Mythology of Common Ground. And one thing that this election and these last 4 or 5 years have made me realize is, you know, we talk about looking for common ground as if it was just out there and had gotten misplaced. All we need to do is find it. But what I have come to realize is we don't have much common ground. I mean, certain of us have common ground with certain others of us, but on a day-to-day level, the lives of people are so different. The lives of people in McDowell County, West Virginia, are so different from my life. And that, I came to realize, that the life, the generic life that I had grown up in, which was, you know, immigrant, white, educated, urban, et cetera, that was not the life of this country, clearly, of many, many people in this country. And so I now see everything in another way. I see this country and even the world, if you look around what's happening, not just in this country, but the other country I live in, Hungary, has its own version of Trump, except he's a smart version of Trump, which is even more dangerous.
Yeah, it's like a DeSantis here, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't want to spend too much time talking about that jamoke, but I find it compelling and important to hear what folks who do value what this country stands for and also value the potential of the human mind, how they respond to what seems to be totally, impractical and sort of counterproductive, especially with your own, with people. A lot of people are voting against their own interest, as I think you probably would agree.
That's
but
right.
I don't want to spend too much of our conversation about that. We want to talk also about your writing, and you know what is you shared with us that you were trying to figure out what you wanted to be, what you wanted to do. Is it safe to say that maybe poetry is high up there on that list, and writing is high up there on that list?
Well, it certainly became that way. I'm not one of those people who knew very young that he wanted to be a writer, and there were no books in my house. My parents weren't educated. The only books we had were Reader's Digest condensed books, so there were no books. And I didn't really even know you could be a writer. It didn't quite cross my mind, just the way I didn't know you could be a primate zoologist. And so what happened, I think, is like many people who stumble into writing, not everybody, but I was lost and I was trying to get found. And I was looking around for ways to find myself. And, I'd always been good with language and I'd always liked reading, but I wasn't a real literary person. And then just as I was graduating from college, all my literary interests started to peak, just as I was at the exit door instead of at the entrance door. And so, you know, I read suddenly D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love, and that sort of changed my view of things. Or I read Tolstoy, and then when I was in law school, I'd never been to a poetry reading, for example. I went to a poetry reading by Robert Creeley, who's not a poet who had much influence on me as a poet, but the reading had a profound influence on me. I went to the reading, and then for about 3 weeks in a row, every night I went to the Cornell Library and listened to the tape, because I was sort of transfixed by the fact that language could be so meaningful, that little bits of language could be so meaningful and powerful as they were to me that night. And then, you know, I graduated and I was still lost. I went to Washington in a job I knew I would hate and did. I just started to write. And I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And then, of course, you can't become a writer without being a reader. So I also started to read much more. I sort of embarked on a self-education program that took place in the mornings in Montrose Park in D.C. from about 6 in the morning till the time I had to go to work. And I just kept writing. And, of course, like many of us who write, the beginning, it was pretty awful stuff. It was embarrassingly awful stuff. It took me a long time to write what I thought was my first poem. I mean, I'd been writing things that looked like poems. They had a lot of white space on the page, but they weren't. Then, you know, once that started, I became obsessed. You know, it was all I wanted to do. It was more important than women, even. You know, it was all I thought about, and was all I, every spare minute, I wanted to read and write. And that lasted for quite a number of years.
When you say a lot of white space on the page, so you figured you were writing poetry. What do you mean by that, a lot of white space on the page?
Well, you know, there are very few things in this world easier to fake than writing a poem. I hate to say it, but I believe it's true, you know. Most people think of poems as, you know, a page with not many words that doesn't go all the way to the right margin, breaks up, and is short, and is about some emotional subject. And that's what I was writing. And, you know, I'll tell you a story. It's a really embarrassing story, but it's a true story. I was in Washington. I was working as a lawyer for the Federal Trade Commission. I was working on an investigation of the California raisin industry. So I was spending most of my days on the telephone with Armenian raisin farmers in Fresno. And I was starting to write poetry, and I thought, well, here I am. You know, I'm a lawyer. I'm thinking about raisins all day. I'll write a poem about raisins. And indeed I did. And what's worse, it was just horrific. What's worse, I didn't know anything about the world of literature, so I only, for some reason, I knew about one magazine called Field. And I mailed this poem to Field. I didn't even know how you do this, submitting poems. So I wrote a little, I thought, well, they'll want to know something about me. So I wrote a little cover bio. Michael Blumenthal grew up, you know, not bragging, just grew up in Washington Heights. He does this, does that. And I put in an envelope, and I had enough, I knew enough to put a stamped self-addressed envelope in with it. And I mailed it off. And about in the amount of time it takes for a plane to get from D.C. to Oberlin and back, it came back in my mailbox. And I opened it up, and below my little bio were written the following exact words, because I'll never forget them. Dear Michael Blumenthal, don't ever lay a trip like this on any decent magazine, .. It marks you, comma, the editors. And then there was a P.S. This poem was really horrific. It was worse than a Madison Avenue commercial. I mean, the first line of it was, I have to laugh, it's really humiliating almost. The first line of it was, a raisin is some sunshine you can eat, which sounds like Del Monte commercial. And the P.S. from the editor said, raisin equals little black boy, particularly offensive, because there was a line in it, this is just to show you how horribly untalented I was. There was a line in it, a raisin is a little black boy left in the bathtub too long, which, in addition to being kind of racist, was awful.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, that's how my poetry career began. And after that, I think it was 6, 7, 8 years before I dared to send out a poem again.
And how old?
They taught me a very valuable lesson.
How old were you when all that happened?
I was 25.
Yeah, so relatively speaking, a kid. So you really made an impression on the industry at first, it seems. And I'm curious, what about the law? When you read the law, you know, I studied law too, and I oftentimes find the law to be beautiful when it's, you know, certain passages inspire, you know, a sense of, you know, an ideal of justice or and such. Do you find that too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've always liked rhetoric. You know, I've often in my spare time sort of write presidential inaugural addresses and speeches. I was a speechwriter for a short time in Washington, not for the president, but for the head of the Humanities Endowment. I think, and my friend and former boss, David Souter, was a good example of that, because he really found the law to be beautiful. He was a very poetic person, you know, a very literate person. It's a different kind of beauty, and sometimes, of course, it can be just boilerplate, boring, repetitive English. But, you know, I think almost any language has the capacity to be beautiful if it's used by someone who has the ability to make it beautiful. You know, whether it's medical language or, but, you know, that's not everybody for sure.
Well said. You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. Well, we're talking with Michael Blumenthal today on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. And, you know, you mentioned Hungary, and you spend a lot of time there, this summers in particular.
A lot.
Why? What's the connection? And why do you like it so much?
You know, again, I told you that most things that happened to me happened by accident, and this kind of happened by accident. It was 1992. I'd been to Hungary briefly in 1986 to Budapest and thought it was beautiful and interesting, but I wasn't there long. I was there for about a week. And then 1992, I was teaching at Harvard, and I invited E.L. Doctorow to give a reading. And he came, and he read, and then there was a party reception for him afterwards. And he said, I want to introduce you to Julia Debrecini, my Hungarian translator. And it turned out that his Hungarian translator had a year's fellowship at Harvard. And we became friends. She had a child exactly my son's age, and we became friends. And then one day we were talking, and I said, I really like Hungary. I'd love to go back there sometime. And she said, well, why don't you apply for a Fulbright? I can get you an invitation. And that's how I wound up in Hungary, really just by accident. And then, you know, that changed my life in many ways.
What year was the first?
That was 1992.
Thank you.
And the Fulbright was extended three times. So I lived in Budapest for 4 years, from 92 to 96. My son was 2 years old and spoke fluent Hungarian by the time he was three. As will happen, I met a lot of interesting people. I met some, you know, very well-known writers and dissidents, among them George Conrad, the writer who was a well-known dissident and a well-known writer. Yeah. And one thing led to another, and then one day I was having a drink with George, and he said, well, why don't you bring your family to our little village and rent a house in the vineyard for the summer? And it sounded terribly romantic, so...
Yes.
We drove out there, and it turned out it was just a beautiful, beautiful place, and rented a house, and spent two or three summers like that. And then, I guess it was 1997, we were living in Texas at the time, and I was invited to the Czech Republic to give a talk, and I stopped in the same village, in the Hungarian village where George and his family lived. I stayed with him. And I'm a very impetuous person. I don't think things over too well. But I sometimes do smart things by accident. And I decided I really wanted to buy a house in the village. And so I asked around what was their house for sale, and there happened to be a house for sale that had been the priest's house. It was uninhabited, had been uninhabited for about 10 years. And I called a friend of mine who was an architect in Budapest, and I said, would you come out here and look at this house with me? And we couldn't get the keys, so we just looked through the broken windows sort of into the house, and I said, should I buy it? And he said, yeah, buy it. And so I had one day left in Hungary before I was flying back to the States. I literally drove to the nearest town of any size, Tapolca. I found a lawyer. We went to search the deed. It was because foreigners couldn't buy land in the vineyards, but they could buy in the village. I signed a whole bunch of papers. I gave him a check. I said, buy it. It belonged to the church. And I flew off. And about a week later, he bought the house from the church. And I never saw the house until a year later. When I arrived, I opened the door, and the architect was sitting at the kitchen table, and he handed me the keys to my now renovated house.
Wow.
And that was 27 years ago.
Wow. Good move.
Yeah.
Good move.
And it was a good move. Yeah.
It was a good move. No doubt. And, you know, the cost of living, I'm sure, there is more affordable than if you were trying to buy a house in Paris or something. So that's...
Well, you know, listen, the truth is I don't even want to tell you what I paid for the house. It's embarrassing. But I couldn't buy a house anywhere else, you know. That was one of the reasons. I couldn't have bought a parking space in Boston for what I paid for that house.
I hear you. Southern Italy, I have a connection there. I go there often. I see homes and villages where people just don't live anymore because they're too removed from any sort of economic opportunities.
Right.
You can buy a three-bedroom house for what's equivalent to $15,000, you know? It's crazy.
Listen, you could buy my entire village for what a studio apartment in Manhattan would cost you. You could buy two villages, I think. And, you know, there are only 270 people in the village, so it's hardly a thriving metropolis.
Yeah, that says something. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to reflect on that. But that says something.
So do I.
So we're just about getting to the end of the time we have this go-around, though I'd love to talk with you again, Michael Blumenthal. I do want to try to string it together. I mean, we've been talking about quite a few things. And one thing that's stuck out to me is you mentioned early in the conversation the human condition, how that hasn't changed much. Though a lot of things have changed significantly in the way our culture is, I guess, at least in the United States, from 69 to today. What do you think we're going to be headed, or where are we headed in the not-too-distant future, based on what you're seeing and what you know regarding the human condition?
Well, you know, I don't know who it was. I can't quite remember. It was somebody from my Jungian days where I was very, who said something about one of the difficulties of human life was that the human soul or the human psyche couldn't keep up with the pace of change, you know, that what was happening in the external world was happening at a pace so much more rapid than what the internal world could accommodate. And I think that is the biggest danger we live in, you know, that we are living in a world that nobody seems to be able to stop and reflect and ask the questions, is this doing us any good? And, you know, that's true of technology, the internet, consumption, Amazon, whatever it may be. And I think that's the major danger to our sort of spiritual existence, you know, how to keep some sense of sanity and groundedness in a world, you know. This morning I went for an MRI, an MRI is a good thing. You can find out all kinds of things about what's wrong with you. But it's remarkable. I'm in this little tunnel, and this machine is bleeping away and somehow taking pictures through reflections of hydrogen atoms. It's remarkable. And some of these things are good, but I think it's the real danger of our lives, and you can see it now, you know, with the mental health of young people, what's happening with technology. Joseph Brodsky, who was a kind of friend of mine, once said to me, you know, that the real danger of human life is that the power of evil is greater than the power of good. And I don't know if that's true, but the forces that somehow have evil results in our lives are very, very powerful and often seem out of our control, you know, and that, I think, doesn't bode too well for the future.
Well, I, in a lot of respects, agree with what you just stated, though. I hope we're wrong.
I hope we're wrong, too. I don't want to leave you on a pessimistic note.
No.
I hope we're wrong. You know, my wife, about 30 times a day, says the words, "We are going in the wrong direction." I guess she's probably smarter than most of us about those things. Maybe yeah. She's probably right.
Yeah, my wife's smarter than me, too. I know.
Right.
Thank God, right?
We're lucky.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Michael. And if people want to look up to see what's going on, maybe find some of your work, I guess just go to the regular places. Is there a website or anything like that you'd like to share?
Well, I have a website that I don't even know if it's done. I never look at it. You know, there are that frequent question that people ask, where can I find your book? As though it was some kind of mystery to find a book. You can find my book where you find everybody's book, you know. Unfortunately, not in the bookstores too often.
Right.
But certainly online, you know, and from the publisher. And, you know, it's no magic.
Well, yeah, we don't want to plug those businesses. I get it.
Right, yeah. I mean, the best thing, of course, is always to buy from the publisher, because the publisher gets the money and they need it very often, especially small publishers. So my present publisher, for example, Rabbit House Press, is a very small publisher in Kentucky, and they need the money a lot more than Jeff Bezos does.
Right. So contact the Rabbit House Press if you want to get his latest book of poems, Michael's latest book of poems, and then you could also... Collins, right? Harper Collins is another publisher, and the Truskin Press. Either way, you're a fascinating man, and you have a good sense of humor, and I had a really nice time talking with you, Michael.
Me too, Lawrence, even though I didn't call you by that radio name of yours, but I'll get it, E.W. Conundrum Demure. You'll have to tell me next conversation how you came up with that.
I'd love to. That's a deal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Lawrence.
Have a
Take
good
care.
One. Bye. an excerpt from Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. All happy families are alike, but an unhappy family is unhappy after its own fashion. Everything had gone wrong in the Oblonsky household. The wife had found out about her husband's relationship with their former French governess and had announced that she could not go on living in the same house with him. This state of affairs had already continued for 3 days and was having a distressing effect on the couple themselves, on all the members of the family, and on the domestics. They all felt that there was no sense in their living together under the same roof, and that any group of people who chanced to meet at a wayside inn would have more in common than they, the members of the Oblonsky family, and their servants. The wife did not leave her rooms, and the husband stayed away from home all day. The children strayed all over the house, not knowing what to do with themselves. The English governess had quarreled with the housekeeper and had written a note asking a friend to find her a new place. The head cook had gone out right at dinner time the day before. The undercook and the coachman had given notice. On the third morning after the quarrel, Prince Stefan Arkadyevich Oblonsky, Stiva, as he was generally called by his friends, awoke at his usual time, which was about 8 o'clock, not in his wife's bedroom, but on a Morocco leather couch in his study. He turned his plump, pampered body over on the springs, as if he had a mind for a long sleep, and he hugged the pillow, pressing his cheek to it. But with a start, he sat up on the sofa and opened his eyes. Yes, now how did it go? He thought, recalling a dream. Now, how did it go? Oh, yes. Alaban was giving a dinner in Darmstadt. No, it wasn't Darmstadt, but some American place. Yes, but the dream, Darmstadt was in America. That's it. Alaban was giving a dinner on glass tables, and the tables were singing Il Mio Tesoro. No, not Il Mio Tesoro, something better. And there were some little decanters who were women, he remembered. Oblonsky's eyes began to sparkle merrily, and he smiled as he continued with his thoughts. Yes, it was a nice dream, very nice indeed. There was a lot that was capital, but not to be expressed in words or even thought about clearly now that I am awake. Then, noticing the streak of light from one side of the heavy blinds, he cheerfully thrust his feet down to feel for the slippers, which his wife had worked in gold Morocco for his last birthday present. Next, without getting up, he stretched out his hand, as he had done for the last 9 years, to where his dressing gown usually hung in the bedroom. And then memory flashed on him how and why it was that he was sleeping not in his wife's room, but in the study. The smile vanished from his face, and he frowned. Oh, dear, 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 he groaned, remembering what had happened, and he went over all the details of the scene with his wife, seeing the complete hopelessness of his position, and, most tormenting thought of all, the fact that it was his own fault.
Grab your hat and take that
fence. Tree trunk next to the slam dunk you said you could provide. I, me, my, do not abide, dude. Rude boy and crude girl. Prince promises a twirl. If only you can remember how to be sweet and complete with charm and soul. I can barely pack my laundry sack. This self-destruction must end before I become too old.
The shape you're in, finger on your eyebrow and left hand on your hip, thinking that you're such a lady killer. Think you're so slick. Well, all right. Pistol in his pocket. They say the man is crazy on the coast. Lord, there ain't no doubt about it. Well, all right. Gonna do. And she said, take two candles and then you burn them out. Make a paper boat, light it and send it out.
Send it out now.
Rosita, ¿dónde vas con mi carro, Rosita? Usted sabe que te quiero, pero usted me quita todo. Ya me robaste mi televisión, mi radio. Ahora quiero llevar mi carro. No me haga así, Rosita. Ven aquí. Hey, usted qué salado, Rosita. Oh.
And there you have it, episode 466 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Michael Blumenthal, Leo Tolstoy, and these musical artists: Thelonious Monk, The Clash, Death Cab for Cutie, the Hungarian National Orchestra, The Band, Mink DeVille, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's do our best to enjoy this time. Take care of yourself and others, too.